on the laptop, but we'll find a way to make it happen. Sorry about that.
Okay, we're just due to technical difficulties. This is the November 18, 2020 meeting of the Board of Parliament Ingersoll Library Trustees. Some of us are present in person, others by Zoom, and we are now recording for posterity. So does anybody have any questions about kind of how it works at this point or anything? You know, just love to talk about it.
When do disbursements happen?
So they typically, people are going to start seeing this on their bill next year. So their June property tax bill is going to have our requests on it, and so will their September 1. So once people start paying their bills, the county has like a disbursement schedule, and I think they disperse like every 2 weeks. So they just kind of like disperse as they get it. So the way that it's actually going to work, and that does, I think, that's a good question for this reason too. The city actually takes in the money because we're taxing through them. So they will set up a designated library fund, and that's just going to kind of be like a pass-through fund for them. So as they receive library money, it gets deposited into like the Canton Library levy fund. And then they just kind of like, it's a one-to-one like turn around and just give us the contents of that fund. So it's not really, I mean, I guess it's got to pass through the city before it gets to us. So we'll probably be on their disbursement schedule too. But I would say, I mean, like certainly we'd start seeing some things by, I mean, July at the latest. And then we'll probably have all of it by October at the latest. So.
Yeah. And from what I heard, Crystal thought that it would just be a direct deposit of some kind. Bill and Zini said a lot of the smaller libraries, because they don't have complicated fund accounting software, tend to put take a disbursement and then put whatever that tax rate percentage is into different funds. So one is just for IMRF, Social Security, you know, audit, et cetera, so that you keep those monies in their same category, because some of those are restricted to only be spent on that particular item. And he said, sometimes you're going to get a disbursement and you won't know how it matches up with your rate. So once you get one big disbursement, he suggested applying that rate to that entire payment to divvy up those monies. So somehow, and I'll work with our accountant on how we will reflect that and move those monies over as we need them. For instance, like the audit, you know, that we usually pay August, September, and that's paid all at once, but something like IMRF or Social Security, that portion would be paid monthly. So we'll have to determine, you know, how the working of the funds is best done. And I think we just rely on, I've asked the auditor about it as that's been coming. So we'll just see what they recommend as we get there. And Sue Fraley also said the bank could set up separate accounts for that. My concern is just we'll have to figure out the logistics, because to transfer, we need 2 or 3 signatures, and how we will do that throughout the process.
Ooh, yeah, that's
it
true.
Could get a little cumbersome, but good news.
Well, and so. I say that part is beyond my pay grade, but I'm very happy to say that we did have just a great result last night. So we'll definitely let you guys know when the truth and taxation hearing is. Like I said, you're welcome to come. Something that Kim and I kind of talked about last night that I think is an interesting sort of like open question is whether it's actually okay to have that hearing by Zoom. So the reason we're able to do this by Zoom is because the governor's executive order modified the Open Meetings Act, you know, to allow for either hybrid like we're doing now or entirely Zoom meetings. But the truth in taxation hearings don't come from that law. They come from a different, like what's called the Truth in Taxation Act. So it's not really clear whether the same order that allows us to do this would also allow for an online hearing under the Truth in Taxation Act. So I think that sounds like an excellent issue for the city attorney to figure out, because it really is their hearing. But you know, if they call and ask, you know, either I or Bill can give our opinion for whatever it's worth. I mean, I would say no, you know, because I think it's a different source of statutory authority, but I'm just one lawyer. I'm not the library's lawyer. I'm not the city's lawyer. So whatever they want to do, like, I'm just going to follow along, I think. So, Anything else on that? Now, thank you all for your support for that stuff. You guys have been awesome, and certainly, you know, it was not. It's certainly like one of the more challenging things that I think we've had to work on. So I'm really glad that we had a good result for it for the library. So let's move on to talk about the parking lot.
Okay, the parking lot is finally done and striped correctly and everything. We're anticipating at this point that Autobahn will be giving us the remaining billings. Since the board's already approved that, I think we're good for that, whatever comes in. They had Phillips and Associates had asked me, do we want to wait and hold that bill till January? They didn't think that was fair. And I said, no, it's been approved. So whenever they give the authorization, we'll go ahead and pay that. I'm thinking the balance is between like 90 and 100,000, somewhere around there on what we will owe them. We've already transferred those funds, so I think we're fine to be paying that when it comes. So really that kind of wrapped itself up nicely, finally. So
wonderful.
Are you pleased with the result? I mean, I haven't inspected it.
Yes, I am. I, you know, I had concerns because I thought it was funny that the first parts of the faulty concrete did not pass spec even at 28 days. And when this all came up and they removed it, the replacement passed it in 7 days. But they say the American Concrete Institute, Phillips and Associates did their due diligence on what was said to be accurate. And at 28 days, if they met that PSI and strength, it's supposed to be fine. So that part was fine. We had an issue on the striping that the subcontractor overlooked, but that is corrected. And the mounting of the handicap signs was not using the correct type of bolting, but that was on the punch list and that has been fixed. So at this point, I assume we're good. The only thing that was a little bit of a hiccup is because it's first year concrete, we did not realize that they're recommending us not use any kind of ice melt of any kind on it, even ice melt that supposedly says it is safe for concrete. So I have on order from RP Lumber, we're going to be getting play sand, and that will be what we'll be using in the parking lot, the drive coming from Locust and the sidewalk so that we don't get any runoff of the ice melt. And the ice melt we already had that we thought was concrete safe does include chemicals that Phillips and Associates said really aren't. So that will be used on the staff asphalt lot and this east side area. And then we did find some salt that Home Depot just delivered the other day that can be used. So I ordered it in advance so we have it. But the you know, there'll be issues with having sand there, tracking sand in, sweeping it up at the end of the year. But for our investment, I think it was well worth whatever we need to do to keep that concrete having a good first year. So
yeah,
we're that's going through the same issues.
Are you?
12 months, they're recommending
yes.
No salt usage. So we're going through the same thing. And some people use kitty litter instead of sand. So they both work.
Okay. Good enough. Yeah, I have a list of 8 chemicals that they gave me. And interestingly enough, if you just Google it, magnesium chloride is on there as supposedly safe, and it's one of the ones they said don't use. So I was glad that in our emails back and forth, Doug mentioned that. So we do have that, and I've talked to Claude Garcia on you know, where it is in the shed and what he should and shouldn't use. So just an interesting one more thing. But good.
Okay, well, great. Well, let's move on to the east side entrance sidewalk and the sump pump replacement.
Yes, I was trying to get more information on that. I did have Quick Electric come and they did the electrical portion of the sump pump. Vaughn's Plumbing is supposed to be getting us a quote on the actual sump pump that was recommended by Phillips and Associates. I have not heard back from them yet. I'm also waiting on them to get back to us on a water heater because the water heater in the back office also is leaking and going out. But I do think that all those things will come in and Doug verified too. He thinks that those estimates should be under the $2,500 limit that I can do without board approval. So the plan on that is I will follow through and get the sump pump work done. I did ask him about the ramp costs, and they're looking at bidding that out in maybe March and April. But they thought that, Doug thought the pump and the piping wouldn't be more than $1,000. But on the ramp, he thought the ramp could be between $25,000 and $30,000. And what he calls the alternate work, which would be leveling the sidewalk out here that is always an ice hazard, $5,000 to $8,000. But that would not happen until March to April when they would go out for bids on that. The reason I wanted to know is I know we were talking about possibly using Marvis Smith's donated monies for that ramp work and for the next item on the agenda, the upholstery. So I just kind of brought this up that I'll be able to follow through on the sump pump, but those might be estimates of what the cost might be on the ramp work. And again, she donated $50,000. So the total ramp work and the alternate looks like it wouldn't be more than 38 or 40. So I think we're good on that.
Great.
And rolling that right into the next one about the quote estimate for reupholstering the chairs. I stopped at the upholstery place, Custom Designs in Peoria. It was recommended by the person that did previous upholstery work for us. And I talked to Scott Gowitz there, and he gave me an estimate quote of just under $4,000. We had not selected a type of vinyl, but he showed me different vinyl that was, they do vinyl by how many rubs that you're sitting on, but he picked several companies that had commercial use, hospital use, that they thought would be very durable for here. And his quote, like I said, was just under $4,000, but that would cover 7 single chairs and 1 2-seated chair. I've been in contact with him. Dan Rock, our maintenance man, can transport all those on his trailer. So if the board approves this, we could be looking at bringing those there as soon as tomorrow. When I priced individual chairs, they've been like $1,200. I brought pictures of our chairs and furniture. Scott thought they looked good. He said usually library furniture, the wood is really good. He even thought the padding might still be good. He won't know exactly until he gets into it and tears it up. But I was impressed with his, you know, his work there. It looked like it would be something worth doing, and it would be a nice thing to do with the donation from Marvis. So, you know, within that range, if the board would agree, you know, spending $4,000, $4,500 or whatever to get that upholstery work done. Normally, Scott does a turnaround, he said, in about a week.
Oh, wow.
He's had some health issues, so I'm not sure the timing, but I don't have a concern about that. So
that would still leave a substantial amount of Marvis's donation remaining, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if this would be about $4,000 to $5,000, I would think we would still, even with the cost of the other, maybe have another $5,000 left. So we'd have to really see when the rest of that work comes mm-hmm. in and the bids. But those are two things that I think are necessary. They're safety issues, and they're things we probably, you know, would have put off. So it's kind of a nice gift, and there were no restrictions on her gift.
Does anybody have any questions or discussion about that?
What's the current fabric?
The current fabric is a woven material. I don't know if it's wool, whatever. It was new in 2004. And it's interesting because of all that was new in 2004, that particular fabric on those chairs is like shredding and has cuts and slits in it. Mm-hmm. And some of our older fabric material does not. Mm-hmm. Scott said they have really good fabric materials, but I told him because of our bed bug issues in the community, we felt that it would be best to go with vinyl and something that we could wipe down.
Okay.
So that was what we looked at for that. But that one, I mean, in a way, the quality lasted 15 years, but they are shredding. If you walk through the building, you'll see that those are shredding. So.
And does he offer any kind of warranty with his work?
That I'm not sure. He did tell me, though, that he felt that this type of material would hold up and last forever unless it was deliberately cut.
Great.
He said it holds up very well.
Sounds good.
Cool. Well, unless anybody else has any other questions or discussion about that, would anybody want to move to approve expenditure of the donation for those projects?
I'll make that motion.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Ooh, okay. Too late. Sorry.
That was Jana on a motion and Chris on a second.
By a hair, though.
Okay.
By a hair. Is there? We'll get you next time. Is there any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none, let's move to a roll call vote.
Okay, Jana.
Aye.
Kim.
Aye.
Laura.
Aye.
Chris.
Aye.
Trig.
Aye.
And Rhonda.
Aye.
Okay, motion passes. So we will we'll see how that all comes in. We'll see what else we have left to spend the rest of that money on. So thank you very much. So the next topic is, I think, on everybody's mind the last couple weeks. So it is COVID-19 mitigation in the library.
Yes. Basically, the governor is moving the entire state to his tier three of his mitigation plan as of Friday. And again, libraries don't specifically fall into any of the categories already set up. But as we are operating, the difference that seems to apply most to us is we are going from groups of 25 to groups of 10. In our case, other than our board meeting and our book club, we don't have any group meetings and we don't have attendance at 10. However, there is a capacity limit, and where we had been at 50% capacity, tier three would mean that instead of monitoring capacity in children's area, in the children's area at like 15 people, we'd more be looking at 8. And then in the rest of the library, it would be about 40 people. We have not had to enforce capacity in any manner since we have been open June 1, but it is something that the staff would be aware of. But under tier three, I think the rest of our operation would operate just as it has been. If there would be further restrictions, we could look at possibilities of operating as we did in March and April and May, where we were closed to the public. I was here as an essential staff member, and I received deliveries and whatnot, and then I called in select staff on an as-needed basis, whether it was to do payroll or we had enough books to catalog or anything like that. We were unable to do anything like curbside because our parking lot was tore up. If we would get to that point where they would do further restrictions, curbside would be something we would consider implementing. We could have limited staff perhaps in the building, but then we could have people call in and we would carry out materials to them. The only other hiccups in this would be if we have staff members contract COVID or have enough staff members that have to quarantine because of close contact with someone with COVID. And we could probably operate minimum hours 9 to 6 with 4 people. If we had any more than that absent, we would have to close or close the 14 days if the health department deemed the entire library needed to close. I can tell you we had one staff member who had a household member that did have COVID. She had not been around any of the public and had not been around enough of the staff. It was a part-timer. And while she tested negative after 6 days, she later then did test positive. She was still under her quarantine and was given the okay from the health department to come back at the appropriate time after her symptoms were gone and the 10-day limit. I have another person that has a situation where someone in their household works with somebody who has tested positive, but they have tested negative. So we're monitoring, but at this point, again, they were told that they could return to work until a positive test might come up. Our building is large enough. Most of our staff are within 6 feet of people. Dealing with the public, we are rarely within 6 feet of people for a total of 15 minutes. So I think all those areas are really pretty safe. Even in the back office, our desks are separated enough that that isn't so much an issue. So at this point under tier three, we're basically operating as we have been, but we will be monitoring capacity. And I don't know if anybody else had any comments on that or any concerns. In the past, the board had said they felt comfortable with if a decision had to be made when time was of the essence, that I could make that decision with TRIG. And I just wanted to reaffirm, you know, that's where it's at. That's how we think we'll handle it. And if everybody is still comfortable with that, then if things would change at a moment's notice, you know, he and I might look at that. And as I did before, I would email everyone to let you know what's going on so you could respond.
How have the employees either changed their mindset at all because of case counts have gone up, or are they
their
feelings as they were, or have they voiced that to you?
I think every individual has a different level of fear with this. I spend a lot of, you know, time calming people, being rational, explaining what our policies are, what the CDC's policies are, how they would be interpreted. The CDC would be making the decisions if more than one person gets ill. Interestingly enough, I found their concerns, as it is ramped up, have become a little more understanding because it's affected people they know. And I think they've been a little more under the realization that it is kind of here and it could happen to anyone, even people that are taking all the precautions that are recommended. But yes, it does ramp up at times, you know, and we just try to keep calm. But I think the precautions we've taken have been good. I would also say the public, we had someone say they would be devastated if we had to shut down. And if that would happen, could we give them heads up so they could come and check out a variety of things before we closed? So I've seen it in particularly our older patrons that the isolation is hard. And I think they appreciate having something to read, having something to watch, having something where they have contact. Because for some people, they have not gone beyond the grocery store, like we're their only outside place they've gone to. So I think as long as we can have that service for the public and keep everyone as safe as we feel is possible, I think it's important. I think we'll always have staff that are a little more fearful than others, whether it's for their own health or any types of health concerns they have. I think we're seeing it everywhere though. I think tempers are kind of ramping up. We've seen, you know, it in the public. We haven't had too many people defiant about wearing their masks, but, you know, I think people are going to get a little more irritable the more they're cooped up and the more we're getting where we can't be outside because of the weather. I don't know if you found that in as far as personnel, but I think it's taking a toll on everyone. No one thought it would be over 6 months and here we're still going. I think people are hopeful because, you know, word about a vaccine is a light in the future, but.
Yeah, I've heard it referenced as COVID fatigue.
Yes, COVID fatigue, COVID panic, COVID fear.
That's a good way to put it.
Yes, I think everybody's feeling that. I've seen it in patrons too.
So, the only thing that I think that we haven't talked about or we haven't just reminded ourselves of that might bear on this a little bit is that we don't have a December meeting. We just don't schedule one. So the next time that we're going to see each other and be able to talk about this stuff is going to be January, unless we call a special meeting. And so it's likely that, you know, if it's going to get worse, it'll get worse probably before January. You know, it's just the way things are going. So I want to emphasize that while, you know, the bylaws allow Kim and I to make that decision and we have to follow the Open Meetings Act, if we're going to talk about business, I would never want to discount or make anybody else feel like their opinion was not valuable about that, because we are, I mean, we're 8 right now, we'll hopefully be 9 soon, but there are 8 decision makers about this stuff. And so while if we need to make a quick decision, Kim and I will do that together because we have to, I know I'll be trying to reach out and try to get thoughts from people, you know, as best we can without violating the OMA. So please make sure, you know, if you guys have thoughts about that, share them with us, please, because it will be a while before we, you know, have another meeting like this. And it's possible that things will really change between now and then. So, okay, anything else on that? All right, well, we will move on to Christmas bonuses and luncheon in that case.
Yes. I included our standard amount that has been given in the past. This year, we have not received tax monies, so I did include this here. But there were a couple of comments from trustees last time on the issue of once we receive tax money, should we continue this tradition? And I did, I guess we need approval for this year. But I did ask Phil Lanzini about it. He's not a fan of Christmas bonuses or bonuses for a reason like a holiday. But I wanted to bring that up to see how everyone felt, if it would be something that, you know, we feel this might be the last year that we would continue that tradition under the circumstances. So I think it's worth people weighing in on that. The other little bit of information there I had was about the staff luncheon. I was very uncomfortable in doing this. Not to be the Grinch, but I just didn't think it was appropriate, one, to close the library, then to have a group of staff here, then to be sharing food, because I have told staff I don't want buffets, I don't want group food. Everything has to be individually wrapped. And we ended up, some libraries were doing box lunches instead. I still felt, you know, to separate everybody 6 feet, sit and eat our lunch was just not worth doing. So what we've done on the staff side as an alternative is a little old fashioned, but they decided to do a secret Santa. So everybody drew a name of somebody, or will be drawing a name of somebody else. It's secret. You're just doing it with your one person. There's no big gathering and big party after it, but it's something that can try to make it a little bit fun. So we will not be doing the Christmas luncheon this year. We won't be closing or ordering food. I just was uncomfortable with the safety issues with that. But there is the issue about the bonuses. So
how does everybody feel about the bonuses this year?
I'm fine with it. I think if any year they're deserved. I mean, maybe do we need to call it something different? Do we need to call it like a COVID bonus?
1 year we did Christmas bonus and bed bug bonus.
No, seriously, like the bank gave out bonuses, mid-year bonuses, and they called them COVID bonuses because, you know, the banking world didn't get to stop when everybody else kind of, you know, had to. So, I mean, is it a situation where we just need to call it something different?
Well, hopefully we wouldn't have to have a COVID bonus next year.
Right, but I mean for this year.
It seems like this is being done because it's been not only a good thing to do, but because it's a long-standing tradition, right? In honoring that long-standing tradition, would we not want to continue to keep it, not just for tradition's sake, but I think it's a good thing. I don't know if we need to call it anything different.
Well, this year, I don't think we have any issue calling it a Christmas bonus because it's all private money. I think what Phil might be concerned about next year is using taxpayer money to fund a bonus for that. And so one way to get around that, or well, I don't want to say get around, is you shouldn't be circumventing laws. I mean, you know, but one thing we could do next year is raise everybody's salary by $100, you know, and happen to pay it around that time, and then they would sort of get their it's not really a bonus, it's sort of their declared compensation. And so that would be one way to sort of do that with taxpayer money going forward. But I think that's kind of more of an issue next year, you know, in terms of like, are we gonna spend the money on it that might be public money, which I think Phil might be a little bit conservative in his reading of that statute, I think, but I mean, safety's good. I mean, you know, and so, you know, better safe than sorry. But we can talk about that again next year. You know, we can see, you know, kind of how we feel, and we might know a little bit more about the public's reaction or lack thereof, you know, to the taxes and everything. So in terms of this year though, it sounds like we might have consensus around going ahead and paying a Christmas bonus out of the trust money. Is there a motion to that effect?
I'll make that motion.
And Jana?
I'll second.
We have Rhonda. Is there any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none, should we take a roll call vote?
Okay. Rhonda?
Aye.
Drake?
Aye.
Chris?
Aye.
Laura?
Aye.
Kim?
Aye.
Jana?
Aye.
Okay. So we'll, at least for this year, and we'll take a look again next year, like with the public money and everything.
Maybe I'll just put it to revisit it in July.
Well, and I mean, also, yeah. And also, I mean, you know, we could just make sure it's trust money that we spend on it too, you know, rather than, so. Anyway, we'll figure it out next year. So.
Aren't such gifts, such as Marvis's, I don't know if that would be.
Yeah, that's true.
How much of those types of monies do you get in each year? I mean, this was a large, substantial.
Marvis, we've never had a gift like Marvis's since I am aware. We had some memorial gifts. A former board member that was a teacher that died, the donations came in, and it was like 3,000. Okay. So that was high for that kind of thing. Normally, we could get $100, $200. We buy, a handful of books. But that was a large one. And we've had a trustee that gives us like $500 every year and asks that it go to children's issues. Mm-hmm. But yeah, nothing like Marvis's. That was like incredible.
Yeah, that was quite an expensive.
So.
Do we get continuing income from Jim's?
Jim Elson. Jim Elson left in his will a piece of money that is creating a trust, and it gives us, this past year it was like 1,800, might be about 1,900. It varies depending on how the investments grow. And that was given to the library with no strings.
Maybe another,
so that's
another
a little endowment that pays interest to us.
I don't know.
Well, Nancy must not have had anything to do with that one if there were no strings.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I said, well, Nancy must not have had anything to do with that one if there were no strings.
Right.
She's been one of our most loyal, dedicated users during this time, so. Well, she really appreciates the library right now.
And she does have to see the statue when she comes by, you know?
Yes.
So, yeah, she gets to do that. So.
Yes.
Yeah, remember when those were the issues that we dealt with? You know, what color is the tile going to be under the statue? So I forgot my packet for this, so I'm going to apologize, but I'll follow along.
Okay.
The next thing on the agenda.
Yeah, this is the per capita grant.
Yes.
Believe it or not, well, we still don't have specifics from the state library on per capita grant. They have affirmed that they will ask that we go through all the checklists in the book. They have affirmed that they will move the deadline back to March 15th. So at this point, I'd like to just go through what we have here, and hopefully they're speaking to us at a meeting on December 8th, so we might have more information then. But I'm not gonna read through quite everything. Hopefully you had a chance to look at it. But I did copy the actual chapters and the checklists.
Yeah. And this was in packets last month, right? So.
Well, and prior to that, I think I handed them out before we actually started discussing to save the postage.
Yes.
But basically, on my sheets that I have numbered with comments, collection management, that's chapter 7. I think we're in really good shape. The area that they've modified a little bit, in the past they had required 12% of your budget be spent on materials. And that was batted around a lot by many libraries in the state. So they have now given a range of a minimum of 8 to 12% be spent on materials. We have consistently over the several years used per capita grant monies to bring us up to that 12%. I'm hoping with our income, we can go ahead and meet that on our own. But I do always put in, as Randy had before me, for per capita to be used for collections and resource sharing. But that is in there, and right now we are meeting that. All the other standards on collections, we do meet. I also listed, they have an appendix I, which you also had, they list how to figure collection spending. On some of it, they also factor in staff time, and if you have an automation system, et cetera, but I've never really seen that reflected on the 8 to 12%. So on collection management, I think we are good. If anybody doesn't have any questions, I'll just roll right on. The next chapter was on system member responsibilities and resource sharing. On that, we do resource share. We have OCLC. We continue to be in Findmore, Illinois. We continue to use per capita grant monies to help us fund those. We do the interlibrary loan policy, which you have approved. The one area on here that I do not have checked is they are stressing that the library administrators, staff, and board members participate on members of boards, committees, task force, advisory councils at the system level, the Illinois State Library, the Illinois Library Association, and other panels. And on that, we have not had the staff time or anyone to participate, but that is one of the checklists that we do not meet there. We don't actively promote statewide taxing library service, which is more of an advocacy role that they're pushing there, but for obvious reasons, we have not. We are a legally established library, so we meet those eligibility standards. But that's basically a comment on these as far as system member responsibilities. The next section is on reference and readers advisory. Again, you can read through those and the checklist, but on all of these, on reference and readers advisory, we really meet the standards well. The thing that I think has really changed here is where they used to require us meeting it with print materials, a lot of it now we are meeting with online items. So we don't have a printed reference book on certain subject areas because that information is available online. Trig and I were just talking, the Illinois compiled statutes is something that we had in print, but it's now available online if anyone would want to look up Illinois law. So we're meeting it. Yeah, like we're meeting it. Yeah, like we're meeting it because we provide online access to that and assist people. So on that, I think we're good. We don't have our own personal community resource file, but the Fulton County Health Department has a list of a number of different services, and we have their brochure up front so we can refer people. And again, we encourage staff to participate in any free online learning. I think it's especially important for part-time people who are the front line of the desk. If people have questions about a good book to read, or, you know, I like reading such and such an author, can you suggest somebody else? The one area that a little uncertain are when they stress having Americans with Disabilities Act compatible adaptability items. And that's something that I think, while I haven't had requests, that might be something we could explore with staff training for in-house, as well as maybe when we update our website sometime. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on readers and reference advisory? I'll move right through to programming. On this one, it was a little bit difficult. In normal, the old normal times, as we always refer to it, we really meet almost all of these. The one area that we don't at this time is we don't have specific programming for young adults. We have been emphasizing birth to about age 8. That's been our primary clientele. When we've tried older programs for older children, they've just not been well received or well attended. I would really like to see our youth services librarian get out there more, visiting the schools, visiting with patrons that come in the library. Again, COVID has kind of squashed that. I know she has a special interest. She would like to start a teen advisory group. I don't know, you know, we've tried those in the past. I don't know if it would go, but when things open up more and she can be out there more, I think that's something that would be worth revisiting. So that's something in that programming checklist that we might strive for in the future. Because the state is really looking at, do you meet, are you striving to meet, and where are you at with the checklist? Some of that is also repeated in the young adult services checklist. Again, one of the things I did not check involves adaptive equipment and software for accessibility. I think that's something we need to explore. A lot of our youth services policies are related to young people. Like, it's in our collection management policy for all ages. It's in our internet policy for all ages, where we address specific things to youth. And again, the other issue on here was just maybe being inclined to a youth advisory group at some point. I don't know if anybody has any comments. I kind of pause too, because I know, Kim Fraley, you work with a lot of young people. If anything here, you know, caught your eye.
Yeah, I was just listening, and I agree that at this time, you know, that's not possible. They're a difficult group to reach. And yes, we have, Kim, tried many times with the library. We've had different ideas, things that we thought would work, but really didn't take off well. You know, we provided lots of great fun activities that included food, because usually when you include food, you know, middle schoolers will jump right on that. But we've just never really been able to draw in that crowd. But I'm just thinking maybe after things settle down over after COVID, you know, when things get back to a more near normal, I think that that would be a really good time to jump on that idea, because students, kids that age are going to be really hungry for that social interaction and that sense of belonging. And I think that that would be a really good time. So planning those things might be a great idea during this time. And then when things come back to a more normal or a near normal, it might be a good time to jump into that, because I think kids are going to be really eager and hungry for those interactions and those type of activities, if that makes sense.
Excellent. Good point. Any other comments? Okay, the next section really, I believe, is the technology section. On that, we really are already doing many of the things that they recommend. While it wasn't in the checklist, one of the things they talked about were patron self-checkout machines. That's something that we've never really felt a need to do. Our traffic isn't as such, and we've always prided ourselves on our customer service and reaching people directly. Some libraries, when they have budget issues, feel that the machine can replace staff and benefits, but we've always prided ourselves on having that personal touch. Another thing was maker spaces, and I think the kids have a lot of that. Our school district has done a wonderful job, but it's not something that I think we need to take on new services, especially at this time. I did mention our program room here. We don't have as fancy and integrated technology as some places, where screens pop down out of the ceiling and whatnot, but what we have does work. But that is something that was also mentioned there. And our website, we actually revamped in, I think, 2015. So it might be something in the next few years to look at. Again, I have been told some of the things with adaptive technology might be something they can look at. When we did it in 2015, they said it was compliant with ADA. I've been told since then they've revised some of those standards, even involving shades of color in color that you use on your website to make them more readable. So, but other than that, I don't have anything else on technology. And that last section is about marketing. Again, I would say, you know, some of the things we're meeting, we don't have a separate marketing staff. Everyone chips in and does a little bit on it. Our marketing goals are included in our strategic plan. We do no longer have a newsletter. It was something that we paid about $900 to have the service to do a newsletter. When we dropped it, we didn't have one comment about it being missed or that people had read it. One thing we have not done is really invited officials to come to our library at all times. We did that at the anniversary, but that is something that they mention, inviting people to visit the library. And we haven't done an annual walkthrough with the board and staff. I think that's something that might be something to look at after COVID. But other than that, does anybody have any questions on those? We kind of whipped through them fast, but I was concerned. We really have come to depend on the per capita grant money, so I wanted to make sure that we at least got through this until we see what's happening, because that deadline had been January 15th, and this would have been our last meeting before that. So now that they pushed it to March 15th, we at least have some time to revisit once we do finally get the official of what they're looking for. So.
Perfect.
Any questions on that? I kind of whipped through it a little bit fast, but and we can always revisit any parts of it.
Okay, well, hearing none, let's move on to the checked out and unreturned items,
okay.
Which is in our packet.
Yeah, that was just a spreadsheet. We've been doing that every year. It's something where it's giving an accounting of items that were checked out but never returned. As opposed to like missing. And when you look at the numbers, you know, we were a little bit more than last year. This would include part of the time that we were closed. So some of those losses are here, some will be carried over next year. But it does include a summer without summer reading, where we usually do get a little bit of a hit. But when you look at the percentage, you know, you might look at the dollar amount and think that loss is high. But when you look at the percentage of what it is to our collection, it's very, very low. And by retail standards, extremely low on shrinkage. So it's just something that is worth looking at. So I just always like to share that with you every year when we withdraw them. We usually wait 2 to 4 months after the item has been lost and overdue before we take it off the system.
Picture books look to be always a big hitter.
Yeah, picture books and DVDs have tended to be, sometimes young adult and graphic novels, it just depends. But it's kind of been an interesting thing at this point. And we've been very forgiving during the closure with COVID, but probably about 100 items on that list were items that did not come back that were due before our closure in March. That we renewed and then we were available and they weren't due till July. So really all in all, I don't think it's too bad considering, but I wanted to share that.
Yeah. Anybody have any questions about that? All right, well, thank you for compiling that information. And let us move on to the board meeting schedule for next year, because this is our last meeting this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing unusual. Hit this like a conference, which is usually what changes. So these are on the third Wednesday. If we have to do an individual change, we need 48 hours notice, but it is legally required to approve these for the year and put it on the website.
So we usually ask, I mean, the third Wednesday of the month at 4, that seems to be working okay for everybody this year. I mean, does anybody have any desire to revisit that for next year?
Works very well for me.
Well, same. Hearing none, we will keep it in that case.
Motion for this?
Yeah, is there a motion to just approve the schedule that's presented?
I'll make the motion, Rhonda.
Ooh, I think I heard I think that time it was Rhonda. So it sounds like
Rhonda first, followed by Chris.
Yeah, and a second by Chris. Second. is there any further discussion? Let's take a roll call vote.
Okay, Jana.
Hi.
Yep.
Hi.
Laura.
Hi.
Chris.
Hi.
Trig.
Hi.
And Rhonda.
Hi.
Okay, very good. I'm going to take over the last thing.
Okay.
I mean, just given everything going on. So.
Yes. I had one other quick question. Traditionally, the board has asked me to present comparative salaries every other year in January. This year, it's almost a little bit of a moot point because of minimum wage increasing and changing everybody's wages, but I am willing to present that data if people are interested. Or if you want to take a pass, that's fine too. I pull that data from the Illinois Public Library annual reports. They don't have 2020's data, but I can get 2019's data. It gives us a picture. Some things that are a little off is it doesn't recognize seniority or years in a position. But I'm willing to do that if people are curious. I'll have that in January. But I just wanted to know. It's just a funny year in so many ways.
I'm curious. Also, is there any kind of geographic factor?
What I've done is I usually pull it with a group of peer libraries. So I pull peer by population and budget, those that are closest to us. And then I do throw in some of the local libraries. So while we're not at, you know, a budget level of Alpha Park, I think it's helpful to see what our surrounding areas are. And I haven't always included some of the smaller suburban Chicago ones that are a lot wealthier. So it is a little bit of a mix in that way. Are you interested? Because I'll just include that in the packet and we can just see if people have questions then.
Sounds good. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Rhonda will make it.
Thank you.
I'll second.
That was Jana?
Yes.
Is that a second? Thank you.
Let's take a roll call vote.
Rhonda.
Aye.
Trig.
Aye.
Chris.
Aye.
Laura.
Aye.
Okay. And let's see, Kim.
Aye.
And Jana.
Aye.
All right, we are adjourned. Thank you guys again for
Thank
that.
You.
We'll see you in the new year, if not before.
Happy holidays. Stay well, everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for all your hard work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Really, really, really pleased with how that turned out. So,
yeah. And I think
it's always,
people seem happy with Zoom. So we'll see what our standing is on how we would do a meeting in January, but I'll keep it. And if the governor extends it, otherwise we should.
Otherwise we,
yeah,
we
don't
have a choice.
We have to pretty much meet in person. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Take care, everybody.
Yeah. Great.
Else?
Okay. Well, I forgot my keys at the bank. I need to go back.
Uh-oh.